Okay. Right, I'll continue now on a completely different thing. So this is a very different aspect that I'm going to try and focus on now. So let's call it beyond the weak coupling limit. Okay, so this is a picture of a macroscopic system, and for such systems, the coupling to the environment can normally be neglected. So the coupling between the system to the reservoir here is normally comparably small in comparison to the energy of the system itself. But for smaller scale systems, this coupling can become relevant. So this is the system, it's coupling to the reservoir, and in comparison now, the coupling here is going to be same size as the system Hamiltonian energies. Okay, so I mean, obviously I'm following on from what Philip already talked about last week, and I think Marty is also going to talk about in 2 days, right, about strong coupling. So I will keep it fairly short, but the main task, as Philip already outlined very nicely last week, is standard thermodynamics, like completely standard thermodynamics, makes always the weak coupling assumption, right? Everything we've learned in school and all that stuff always makes the assumption that you can treat your system as weakly interacting with the environment so that it can thermalize somehow, but that's it. After that's like it's thermalized, there's no more impact of the environment. But the question is, all of these laws of thermodynamics and all of the rules that we know, can they be extended to the case that this assumption is not true anymore? So, you know, the second law and the fluctuation relations and all these things, can you extend this to the case that the system is small, the interactions are not negligible, and what do you do then? Okay, that's the game. And so Philip already summarized a lot of the things that generally the research community has found. So a lot of things can be done. And the main point is that you have to include corrections in your thermodynamic description of such a system. And these corrections come from the interaction. So very briefly, because Harry will need this, So the sort of situation that mostly is being considered is this. So you have a Hamiltonian. This is written in a classical way with phase space coordinates here and force parameters, lambda. So you have some global Hamiltonian. It has a bare part on the system. It has a bare part on the bath or reservoir. And there's an interaction term. And so when you take a global thermostate of the system and the bath, like this, right? The point is that when you take then the reduced state of the system, it is not going to be a Gibbs state with respect to the bare Hamiltonian anymore when the interaction term is non-negligible. When it's negligible, then of course this reduced state will simply be a Gibbs state, but otherwise it isn't. And this is where you introduce a new Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian of mean force. It simply is defined as the thing with respect to which that reduced state of the system is Gibbsian, okay? So this guy is an effective Hamiltonian here, mean force Hamiltonian, that has the bare Hamiltonian in it, but then it has a correction term, and that correction term arises basically from the interaction, which is there, and it also will depend on temperature, or inverse temperature beta. So that's very unusual. Normally in thermodynamics, Hamiltonians don't depend on temperature. They are separate things, temperature and energies. Now the Hamiltonian does depend on temperature, and that's why we can expect things to change in standard derivations. Okay, so this is what the Hamiltonian of mean force is. And I think I'm going to skip a lot of stuff. This is what Philip already talked about. You can define stochastic energies, entropies, free energies for such sort of systems, and so they are looking pretty much the same as before. This is classical, so this is basically the energy of a system along its trajectory, but then there's an additional term that comes from the interaction, and also the entropy. I think this is a very interesting thing to see, that normally you take the entropy as log of the probability distribution, minus log. But here now you have an additional term that comes from the coupling. So what I'm saying is you can find thermodynamic potentials that are very similar to the standard thermodynamic potentials, but have additional correction terms that come from the interaction with the environment. And if you do it this way, then you get pretty much you get everything you want. So I think I'm going to skip all of this. But basically, you get extensivity that your system and environment can be treated as you know extensive objects as you want it in thermodynamics, standard thermodynamics. And you get all the other stuff. You get, for example, you can do trajectories. This is classical. So you can write down a Crookes relation, which relates the forwards probability distribution of entropy production with the negative, the time reversed bit. And you can then also find such a relation. OK, I'm just going to skip. So the main point is you get the same thing as standard thermodynamics if you take into account the corrections correctly, okay? Right, I'll briefly go in the start of this. So this is what Harry's going to talk about in a minute. So the thermodynamic uncertainty relation is something that says, okay, so in quantum mechanics, we have an uncertainty relation, right? X and P and stuff. But in thermodynamics, there's also something called uncertainty relation that goes back to Bohr as well, apparently. And this is an uncertainty between energy and temperature, okay? So I mean, the simplest way for me to understand this in the first place is to think of the microcanonical ensemble. If you think of the microcanonical ensemble, then your system is an ensemble of states that is all in one energy shell, right? So energy is fixed and sharp, but you have no temperature. There's no notion of temperature. So when
notion of temperature.
Okay. 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 Let's. Yeah, okay. Well, fine. So let's discuss about this. I don't understand this part yet. I'll learn. Right. But so the canonical ensemble sort of tries to lets the energy fluctuate, right? So energy fluctuates. Delta U is not zero anymore. You have a notion of temperature. This is a parameter, so it should be sharp. But actually, the temperature will also be a parameter that you would have to estimate and measure. And when you measure it and try and estimate what the value of that parameter is, you will have uncertainty in that parameter. And so that's a sort of the meaning of that inequality. There is a trade-off between how much uncertainty you can have in these two things. Robert doesn't agree. Okay. Right. So. One of the main things that I want to say to before Harry can start deriving this is the following. So in the weak coupling regime, in the normal standard thermodynamics regime, there are two things that we use a lot, and that's the Gibbs state, the thermostate, which is simply e to the minus beta hs with the bare Hamiltonian, and of course the energy, which is take that thermostate and take the same hs, and then you calculate the energy of the system, right? But in the strong coupling regime, first of all, the state changes to become thermal with respect to the Hamiltonian of mean force. Okay? And the other thing that happens is that the energy here is now an expectation value of that same state with a different energy operator. Okay? The two of them, so first of all, this here becomes different because of the corrections due to coupling. But this here also becomes different in a different way. Okay? So you get two energy operators, really.
But sorry, how do you find the energy if you have strong
coupling? So E, this E, so HS is already defined. It's the thing that makes the reduced state Gibbs. But this E I haven't defined yet. The E is the thing. So we still want to keep that definition, that US is, this is d beta log Z. And Z is now this Z. So if you take that Z and work out what US is, you will find that you cannot use HS star there to get the correct US. Okay? That motivates that you have to choose something else. And the ES is then this. The ES is beta H star and then differential with respect to beta. So let's check the weak coupling limit. In the weak coupling limit, HS star becomes the bare Hamiltonian HS, independent of temperature. And d beta here applied to this is simply going to differentiate this, and you are just left with the bare Hamiltonian HS. So in the recoupling limit, this E becomes the bare Hamiltonian.
Is it now quantum or classical? This is both.
This is quantum and classical. Okay. Right. Okay, I think, okay. Yes, how far should I go? So the energy operator is that, and now the question is, so this is an example that we've worked out for a damped harmonic oscillator. Yes, so here this is the actual Hamiltonian of mean force. So this is still a harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, and what happens here is that the mass and the mass of the oscillator and the frequency become dependent on the temperature through the interaction with the buff. Okay, so they start to be rescaled, and you can also write down what this E star is. And E star is something that you can express as it's still H star times some alpha. So that part would be commuting, but there's an additional term, this term over here, which you can see that this is going to be not commuting with H star. You see what I mean? So this is really, really interesting because it means that the Gibbs state, which is Gibbs with respect to that Hamiltonian, the canonical state in this picture, is not commuting anymore with the energy operator. Okay? And that's a result of the strong interactions. So in that sense, the commuting, the non-commuting can only happen, of course, in the quantum case. But the effect only happens when you have strong coupling. So both of them have to come together, quantum and strong coupling. Okay, right. So back to this uncertainty relation. So we want to show this uncertainty relation, but with strong coupling. And to understand what delta beta is, you have to understand that you have to estimate this, and I'm not going to go through this. But the main point is that you then can derive something called the thermodynamic uncertainty relation at strong coupling, which you can write like this. So, you know, we've previously had delta beta times delta U, that is the standard thermodynamic uncertainty relation, and now it becomes delta beta is bigger than this, so here's delta U, right? If there's no Q, then this is the standard relation. But what you see now is that there is a Q, and that Q has to do with the non-commutativity of the canonical state with the energy operator, and it's something called the skew information. And
so,
I think
sorry,
yes.
I was lost at some.
I know everyone is sleeping now.
Where did you have to define the reduced state density matrix? Because you could simply proceed without defining any reduced density matrix. You just use, if your system is strongly coupled,
yes.
You use the density matrix for the full Hamiltonian, including also the,
yes.
Without any density matrix in the middle.
You mean you want to treat the system
yeah.
And the reservoir, all of it?
Yeah,
that's possible. In principle, mm-hmm. It's possible, but that's not what we're talking about. We want to have the system coupled to the reservoir and still want to sort of see whether we can do thermodynamics just with the system.
Just for the system,
yes.
Okay. Okay.
So we reduce the state, but that state now is not Gibbs because of the correlations with the environment.
But, yeah, one thing is the evaluation, for instance, of the energy stored in your system.
Yeah.
But to define that, you can do that with the density matrix of the full system. So one thing is the average.
Uh-huh.
And another thing is the density.
Andrew, I'd like to remove
operator.
This now. Do you know how? You mean the energy?
Because you can still evaluate, for instance, your delta US.
Yeah.
But these are mean values. And to evaluate those mean values, you can proceed with the full.
So the fundamental problem is this. You have a system and a bath that have a state rho, and that have a Hamiltonian H. But what we want is we want to just talk about the system state and the system Hamiltonian. Okay?
Yeah, but you want to talk about rho S, or you just want to talk about the energy stored in in your S, in your system? Because there are different things.
Okay.
In order to evaluate the energy or any mean value of what you store in your system, you can use the full density.
Of course. But I think the question is, what's the energy operator? So the thing is, we know how to, so let me just put some things on. So what we want is, we want to have an effective description of the system, given that it interacts with the environment.
I agree.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we have a description of how to get this reduced state. It's simply this one, right? Trace over that.
Yeah,
right.
My question is,
the problem is this.
Necessary?
So I think what you're saying is you can take, you can still take this and take some H, and that's going to give you the energy. But that's not going to be right. So what I'm saying is, if HS is that bare Hamiltonian,
yeah,
this is not going to give you the right energy. Okay, this is not the right energy.
Which is not the right energy? The energy of the system?
Yeah, because it's a question of accounting.
If
it's strong coupling, you somehow have to, I would say, it boils down to the question I'm interpreting
you.
That how to account for each interaction.
Yes.
This is, in a way, I would say that.
The way to account for the
H interaction.
H interaction is to include in rho.
To
put everything.
Yeah, but
there.
When I say energy,
if
we
put the full Hamiltonian, you take into account everything.
Yeah, but then the question is, you want to partition it to the energy of the system, the energy of the bath. So you want to say, how much energy does the system carry with it? So if it's weak coupling, you know it's only the bare Hamiltonian.
Exactly.
If it's strong coupling,
then what?
So this is a certain, I would say, choice.
It's a choice.
Of accounting, which my accounting office may accept it, maybe not next year.
So my accounting office, so what we're saying is, just to briefly summarize, and then Mark had a question. So what we're saying is that if you simply choose your bare Hamiltonian HS to be the thing that measures energy for the system, then you run into inconsistencies of the second law, which I've had to skip because I have no time. But this is the motivation of including additional terms. So you want to have correction terms that come from the fact that you have interactions.
No, I basically agree with that. I'm just saying that you don't need to introduce any reduced density.
Yes, I don't. This is actually, the focus is on the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but you want to do that to get the entropy.
Okay.
You can use the full density operator of all your
taking
into
account everything. Okay, so the point is, the Hamiltonian we're going to use for the system is this mean force Hamiltonian. Okay, this is a choice. Briefly on the choice, so the assumption we are working with here is that the magnitude of HS is sort of comparable to the magnitude of V int, but it's much, much smaller than the magnitude of HB. So in other words, you can't take this approach for 2 qubits. Okay, 2 qubits, not good. So if this is system and this is bath, this doesn't work, because that's not the right thing then. But if this is really a huge bath and this is a system, then this is a reasonable approach, okay? Okay, Mark, did you have a question?
Yeah, I would have thought the answer depends on what you're going to measure and how you're going to measure.
I agree as well. Yes, absolutely. Okay, I think I'm going to stop now.
Okay, so I have another question.
Yes.
So a number of years ago, I wrote a paper with Karine Lavore where we sort of worked on the same kind of problem.
Uh-huh.
And we had kind of a different approach to it. And so one of the things we did is we said, when you reduce the system density matrix, you can think about the fact that it's in some thermal state because it's entangled with some bath, even though it's bathed in the thermal state. You can think about it as some kind of effective temperature of the system. And so our approach was to say, introduce some effective temperature of the system, and then try to see how this thermodynamic law is working.
Yes.
Have you thought about this kind of approach?
We haven't used this approach, but there are several other groups that have done this approach. For instance, Tony Asin's group has several papers on effective temperatures. And actually, what I remember from one of their papers, I don't have the reference, a few years ago, was that they were trying to. So they kept the Hamiltonian the same, something like this, like the state, the reduced state, they still want to have it. So this is fixed, but this one here can now vary.
Yeah, that's exactly what we do.
And you can only approximately get this right,
yeah.
Not correct, perfectly. So the problem is then to optimize, find the optimal beta tilde that gets you as close as possible. Yeah, that's an alternative approach. I have no particular preference at the moment. My physical thinking about it is like this, right? I mean, if we're actually talking about this room, that has a temperature, and you are here. Right? So, okay, well, then you are self-organized. This table is here, right? I still want to think of that table having the temperature of the whole thing. I don't want to think of that table having a different temperature from the room. So for that reason, I would like to keep the temperature fixed, but change the effective energetic description. But it depends, again, on the situation you're looking at.
But then it's weird because the effective energetic description also depends on the temperature in some weird way.
Yes.
So this is also kind of unsatisfying.
Because I was in one of these papers.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I wasn't sure anymore.
One of the messages is that what you can do, so you, in this picture that you wrote, you could take a boundary of your system.
Uh-huh.
Slightly bigger. And then what you see is that this reduced state is very well described by a thermal state of system plus boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like an effective way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now? Okay. Yeah? Okay. So Harry's going to now talk about the uncertainty relation in a little bit more detail. I guess I give this to you.
If we're done with the projector, can you turn this off?
Yes.
It's blending very
bright.
So I'm going to sort of give you another separate thing to talk about. I know we've had a lot of things here, but so I'm going to link three things together. I'll get back to this strong coupling stuff in a minute. So I'm going to be talking about something called the Wigner-Yanassi skew information. So I'm going to link this to strong coupling. And I'm going to show how this leads into this thermodynamic uncertainty relation linked to. Hopefully, I've got enough time to get through all of this stuff. Okay, so has anyone heard of this before? This big massive information? Okay, I'll talk about that. So. This was introduced in the 60s by Wigner and Yanassi as a way of quantifying the quantum uncertainty in an observable. So they were thinking along the lines of, suppose we have a pure state and some observable A. Now, normally the uncertainty in this would just be, you know, the variance in this observable. But then what they were concerned with was, suppose we have a mixed state, a general mixed state, how do we quantify the uncertainty in this observable, but only due to the quantum contributions to the state? So can we split this variance into a quantum part and a classical part. So what they defined as a quantum uncertainty measure is to satisfy three things. So firstly, you want these two things to be positive. You want the variance of this to be equal to the quantum part if this is pure. It's So, and the last condition is you want the quantum measure to decrease under mixing. So in other words, if you take a classical mixture of states, you shouldn't be able to increase the quantum uncertainty by taking a convex combination of states. So just sort of formally. So whatever this measure is, if we take a classical mixture of states, this should decrease, right? So. So there's no unique way of doing this. So you know, it's a bit abstract because there's an infinite number of ways you could measure such a quantity. But I'm going to sort of argue for a specific quantity that shows up directly in strong coupling thermodynamics. So what they proposed as an actual choice of this function is the following. So this is the thing that they call, you know, the SKU information.
Sorry, what is piece of I again, a little p?
Just probabilities.
Of what?
So just if you have a set of states, just take a convex combination of
just any weighting then.
Yeah, any normalized weighting, yeah. So this thing is defined through the commutators between the mixed state and the observable. So. Okay, and this parameter A sit between 0 and 1. So they originally proved that this thing satisfies these three conditions for alpha equals 1/2, and then it was Lieb in the 70s with his concavity theorem finally proved that this thing is it satisfies this convexity for classical mixtures. So the quantity I'm going to be talking about is slightly different to this. So there's this arbitrary dependence on alpha. We can define. I'll put it here. So the quantity I'm going to be talking about is an average over this alpha. So we just take the integral over all of these parameters. So yeah, again, this seems like an arbitrary choice, but it turns out that this thing shows up exactly in thermodynamics, which is the interesting thing. So part two, strong coupling. So I'll just recap what Janet was talking about. So we have some Hamiltonian of a system above, and we assume everything's in canonical equilibrium, so the reduced state of the system is going to be this thing that we had before, so this mean force Hamiltonian. Okay, so this thing is just. So what Janet was talking about was this energy operator is not equivalent to this Hamiltonian. So the energy of our system, remember, is given by this partition function that we have, this effective partition function. And this is equivalent to the total energy of this whole thing minus the energy of the bare reservoir, bare bath. So it kind of makes intuitive sense. So we're attributing the energy of the strongly coupled system to the energy you need to immerse it in the composite state. So we subtract the bare energy from everything.
So how's that defined?
Sorry? How do you define the bare energy?
Ah, okay, so this is just... so the bath without any coupling, okay, and its average of its energy, right? So of course, if the interaction like is small compared to the Hamiltonian of the bath, then the reservoir is going to be approximately in this state, and so it's kind of natural to subtract this energy off. So what we were talking about was we want to introduce an operator which describes this. This is an average quantity. So if we want to talk about fluctuations in the energy, we want to introduce an operator. So this is the thing that we had before. So it turns out that this average is given by this thing. So in other words, yeah, it's just the trace of this. So it's kind of surprising because you might expect, so this mean force Hamiltonian is really used just to give you the partition function, but it doesn't.
So what is E sub S now? Is this something different from the system Hamiltonian?
Yeah. It's different from both the bare one and the mean force one. But this is the thing that actually describes the eigenstates of energy in the strongly coupled system.
I'm just trying to make sure that the mean force is this H star.
Yes. This is
you have a name for this thing and the other thing?
Effective energy operator, I guess.
So if I take just the bare Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian system bath coupling bath, I take its expectation value in a full mini body state, I get three terms. So is E S star accounts for both energy and coupling energy?
Yes. So this accounts for the difference between the total energy. Yeah.
So you're lumping in the interaction energy with the system.
I'm minusing the energy of the reservoir in the absence of the interaction.
In fact,
the system with a captain minus the ship.
If I may, in fact, it contains also information about the bath. Not only the interaction.
Yes.
It's USB. It's USB minus U. So this operator in fact contains information about the full Hamiltonian, not only system and interaction.
Because you can't separate them.
It's a global kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because you're only subtracting the uncoupled bath expectation. Okay. So there is some residual bath.
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
Yeah. Right. So. Okay, so the key point is that in general, if this interaction does not commute with these bare Hamiltonians, then the system is actually going to have a set of coherences with respect to energy, at least energy measured through this operator. So they don't commute because you're taking the derivative of this temperature-dependent thing, and it's just going to be a complicated mixture of operators. So what we're actually going to see is that this non-commutativity can be quantified through this skew information, and it shows up quite naturally in thermodynamics. And the way it shows up is through the heat capacity. So I'll come over to here. So let's look at the heat capacity. So this is just the defined as the rate of change of this average energy we have over here, so with temperature. So normally in the weak coupling case, we know that this is equivalent to the fluctuations in energy, right? So for weak coupling, CS is going to be equal to the variance in energy of the E squared. Well, I guess we've said Boltzmann constant. But we get something interesting in the strong coupling case. So we get corrections to this relation. So here's the main point that I'm trying to show you. So in the strong coupling case, we find that the heat capacity is given by the variance in energy from this thing over here minus the skew information with respect to this operator. Plus an extra dissipation term. Okay, so we get two corrections, two additional terms. So this, of course, is measuring the fact that we have coherences in energy in the strong coupling case. And this term is actually a classical correction term. So this remains even if the interaction and everything commutes. So it stems from the fact that the energy operator is going to depend on the temperature of the bath around it. So how do we get this? Well, I'll just show you like a few steps. So the first thing is we can write this difference here as an integral. So this is just the operator minus its average. Okay, so it's just this is just ES star minus average energy. So the reason that we can connect we have this funny integral here, and the reason that this connects to the thermodynamics is the following. So if you differentiate an exponential operator. So say we have some parameter here, which in our case will be temperature, and some operator that depends on this. This turns into an integral like this. So you can kind of see how this fits together. So we're going to be differentiating when we evaluate the heat capacity, we take the derivative of essentially this exponential up here. And because this depends on temperature, we get the energy operator fits down here. So yeah, I'm not going to go through the exact steps, but you can kind of see why these two things link together.
So for the first part, you know what is delta U because you know E and the average, and you use the Q.
Yeah, so yeah, you can manipulate this expression. If you minus the variance of this thing, then you get this leftover term here.
I guess this is non-trivial because the derivative of the operator doesn't commute with the operator.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, so of course if these two commute, then this integral vanishes and you just get the usual thing here. Okay, so this is a first sort of example of where quantum mechanics comes into this, corrections come into this strong coupling regime. And in fact, there's lots of papers showing that this can actually be negative, so that you get these anomalies where the system's energy actually decreases as you heat it up. And this occurs around at low temperatures. So at low temperatures, this term dominates. And this thing is also not generally a positive operator, so this dissipation term can also be negative. So that you can get situations where this whole thing becomes negative.
But that would lead to a thermodynamic instability, right? If this were a real system.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's...
Yeah. I don't agree. No, it's still stable. The whole thing is in thermal equilibrium. Mm.
What does instable and unstable mean in that situation?
Mm.
Yeah.
If you
were to reach
the level
that
very close.
Right.
It means it wants to suck energy out of the bath and keep heating.
Exactly. Mark the internet. Right. So if this were a physical fact, this exact phenomenon would take place. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what would be the consequence of having this negative heat capacity for thermal equilibrium?
I'm not so sure yet.
No,
Yeah, I mean, well, in
the sign of the thing, you know, I mean, you have this inequality of efficient information that then has to be negative.
Yeah, but remember, when I get to it later, it's balanced out by this term. So it's always, it doesn't violate that.
Okay.
You'll see it.
Yeah, let's keep pushing
the expression. Maybe even do efficient information, and I guess we need to stop it.
Right, so I'll get to the final point over here, which is this uncertainty relation, which sort of connects all of these things together. So yeah, I think the main point is the total heat capacity is always positive, right, the composite thing, so it's always going to, it's not going to be unstable because the whole thing is still in canonical equilibrium, right? Mm-hmm. And you get negative heat capacities in the microeconomic ensemble and other situations. So, right, so we can actually apply these ideas to thermometry. So the idea we have now is, suppose we use our system as a thermometer. So we want to probe the temperature of the reservoir or the bath, but we only have access to the system. So it turns out the standard setup for this is through the Fisher information. So I'll try and explain this. So we have system and bath, so the system depends on temperature of the bath, right? But it might be strongly coupled. How can we infer the temperature of the system, of the bath through the system? Well, we take some P of the M, perform it on the system, and we record the data, and we can optimize our experiment over all P of the M's. So maybe I should write this a bit more formally. We construct... depending on our choice of P of the M, we'll have some conditional probability dependent on the temperature. So let's say our P of the M's are like this. So we have a set of operators that we choose. And when we act these on the system, we get some distribution dependent on the temperature. And then we construct.
Sorry, what is now the temperature?
It's the temperature of the total.
So you still assume that the full thing is.
Yeah, so this is all in. In global equilibrium.
And you want to sort of learn about this global temperature from looking just at the system?
Yeah. So normally in this situation you assume weak coupling and you bring in a thermometer, you let it reach equilibrium and then you read off the data from the thermometer. But now we're saying, let's do the same thing, but now let it strongly interact, right? So it's going to be, actually the thermometer is going to be in one of these states over here.
Right, except for those strongly interacting, there is an additional super bath. Because the full thing is in a thermal state.
Yeah, but like, for example, in Brownian motion, you can just take some state of the thermometer uncoupled to a canonical bath, turn on the interaction, and it will eventually reach this as a steady state without a super bath involved.
Let's discuss this.
But yeah, you can include a super bath. In metrology, we take our P of the M, we construct a function that maps our outcomes onto some estimate. So this is the estimated temperature, and it's a random variable with this probability. So it's going to have an uncertainty attached to it, depending on how we choose the P of the M. So we add another condition that our measurement scheme is unbiased or locally unbiased. So we assume that we have a thermometer that on average gives us the right result. We can actually relax this condition to sort of more weaker requirements. So this is where this notion of uncertainty in temperature comes from. So it's dependent on how we measure the actual system. So we use a thing known as the Kramer-Rao bounds to find out what the optimal uncertainty is over all measurements that we can do. So what we find is delta beta, sorry, I'll put this as a variance, is always greater than the Fisher information. So the Fisher information is a function of the state alone, so it doesn't depend on the actual heat of the air. This is the quantum Fisher information. This basically tells us what's the best thing we could do, what's the best measurement scheme we could construct. And this thing is defined as follows. So remember, we have a strongly coupled state here. So it's an expectation value over a set of operators here, which are defined through an operator equation. Okay, so I mean, I don't want to go into too many details, but essentially, to compute the Fisher information, you have to solve this equation and find out what these operators are. And you can plug this in, and this tells you what the ultimate estimation of temperature
is. I'm confused about what problem you're trying to solve. I would have done this in the following way. I mean, and the thermometer on the wall works because we believe the thermometer has some physical property that's related to its total energy, which it gets from coupling to the air in the room. Mm-hmm. So I would have computed the expectation value of HS in the global Gibbs state.
Yeah.
Assuming I have the ability, I know everything about the Hamiltonian interaction and everything else. I would have plotted that as a function of beta, and then I would, measure that energy, and then I would be done.
Okay.
But I wouldn't need Fisher information. I wouldn't need all this. So, why do you need all that? What are you doing that's different than that, and why do you need?
First of all, we're saying we can't measure the total energy of everything.
No.
You're measuring HS, but you have to know HS.
Right. So you must be assuming you don't know some things. So I'm not sure what you're assuming you don't know.
So we're saying on average we get the right temperature, right? And it turns out at least in the weak coupling case you do measure energy, but you want to construct. So obviously to get that you need to do an infinite number of measurements, right? To get an accurate.
I think you're talking about. So I think you're saying you want to measure the energy HS at global state, and that gives you a way to estimate the temperature.
But
you would have to do many, many measurements to actually get the statistics. Then you get an estimate of your temperature, and that's fine. But this here is theory about how to optimally measure something without assuming what HS is. So this is a general method. I mean, it goes back to. When were the first papers published on this estimation theory? So this is very general about optimally measuring a parameter, doing anything you could possibly on the system. So you could measure the energy or anything else.
I think the key point is you described the way of measuring temperature, but we want to optimize our uncertainty in our estimate over
Okay, but the only uncertainty in my estimate is going to come from fluctuations in the energy of the system. So you're assuming the system is small enough that I have to worry about fluctuations in the energy.
I mean, that's fine. Yeah, so the...
Okay, so you want to measure, you want to find something better about the system to measure that will minimize those fluctuations.
Yeah, so I mean, you're right, it turns out...
Very different than energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in the weak coupling case, energy is the thing you measure. So in this Kramer-Rao bound, the thing that saturates this inequality is by doing energy measurements. What I'm going to show now is in the strong coupling case, you need to measure a different thing.
You are speaking with the idea of ensembles, so you are not talking about time. So you are imagining that you have an infinite number of copies of the same thermometer.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's an asymptotic.
Where does time come into this place?
There's no, you're letting it thermalize, right? So you've got to wait for everything to reach equilibrium. But I mean, that's going to depend on the situation.
So if time comes, it's infinite.
Yeah, T is infinite.
Let me also comment here. So you're assuming idealized measurements on system observables, right? Mm-hmm. And so all you need to do this is just to reduce system state.
Yes.
So you don't need any of this effective mean force Hamiltonian to calculate.
That's right, for this part, yes.
But do you need to know what the interaction is?
Essentially, yes. Okay. You're going to need to know, because you essentially, so the way
you can't do it.
No, but so the you want to measure it. It turns out to saturate this, you need to measure in the basis of these operators, and to compute these operators, you need to solve this equation, which means you need the interaction because you need to know how this depends on time to join. That's like, yeah.
One other issue, I guess, is that when you try to make, you're trying to measure a bare system operator, but that system is strongly coupled to something else. So practically, that's an extremely challenging demand for experimentalists to do.
Yes.
That's a comment.
Yeah. So we have an example on Janet's slides of what this mean force Hamiltonian looks like, and you can sometimes get situations where you can come up with quantities that you can compute and measure. But I don't want to go into too many examples, really. But the key thing we have here is we prove that the Fisher information is less than variance in energy minus the skew information. So this is something that we prove in the paper, and if you combine that with this thing, then we get this uncertainty relation here. So we find out what the optimal uncertainty is, and it's so this is the main result. So as Janet was mentioning, the original uncertainty relation that people have derived since, I think it goes back to 40s or 50s, was this one here. So this is what you're saying. So in the classical case, the weak coupling case, the optimal measurements are energy measurements, and you saturate this thing by measuring energy. But what we find here in the quantum case is we get a tighter inequality related to the fact that this operator no longer commutes with the system. So this skew information now constrains our ability to measure the temperature. So I've shown two examples of where this skew information comes into strong coupling. So it modifies the heat capacity and it modifies the achievable fluctuations in temperature.
So it makes it worse.
Exactly.
It makes it worse.
I guess, yeah. I don't know how you quantify worse, though.
Uncertainty in temperature
is bigger,
right? You want to minimize your temperature uncertainty.
Yes, but this depends on interaction as well.
Yeah. It's not necessarily a worse.
It shows how coherence effective it is. To answer whether it's worse, you'd have to find out the trade-off between these two quantities and how they scale with like low temperatures.
As a function of interactions.
Which is an open question, really.
But it can be, in specific cases, can be much better.
Yeah. Or so I think the key thing to prove in the future would be how these two things scale at low temperatures. Because obviously at low temperatures, this thing is going to become really large. So the main issue with low temperature thermometry is In the weak coupling case, it becomes exponentially inefficient. But it turns out you can find examples where strong coupling gives better scaling at low temperatures. And so it's going to, I mean, this has still not been shown in concrete way, but this is going to be related to the coherences in this term. In Lewis's paper, they found better sub-exponential scaling at low temperature in the Brownian oscillator example, right? And this stems from the strong interaction. But I don't exactly know how this was related to coherence.
Okay, it's related to the spectrum of the global Hamiltonian. It's a gapless system. Even when you lock up thermometry, you get this polynomial scaling of the fission information with temperature. But if it's a gap, if you have a gap system, because you have this finite gap, you get an exponentially inefficient low temperature thermometer. You get a bound that goes exponentially fast to zero as you send the temperature to zero. So you get a millibar scale. But this is because your global system is gapped. Yeah, make it gapless, then you get better scale. Yes. But it doesn't really have to do with the state, it has to do with the Hamiltonian.
So just a question to understand better. So this Q that appears there, is that because quantum strong or both of them together?
It's both of them together. Because if the interaction is weak, then these two things will commute, right?
Okay. Interaction is strong, then the system is classical, this Q will
vanish, yes. But we also get a classical correction. So this is the second part of the result that we can use from here. So remember over here, the heat capacity also has this term here. So if we choose to measure temperature instead of inverse temperature, we can actually get a similar result. So if we look at the optimal signal-to-noise ratio of estimating T, then we find that this is less than the heat capacity minus this additional term. Okay, so in the weak coupling case, the original result says that the signal-to-noise ratio is always restricted by the heat capacity. So the best thermometers are ones with a high heat capacity. But what we find here in the strong coupling case is we have an additional dissipation term, which still persists even if everything commutes. So there's additional factors to optimize over if you want to design a strongly coupled thermometer.
So this Q I can repeat this strong coupling in part of the network just with using Hamiltonians, which are functions of phase space, and do this classically, not?
Yes.
So when I find Q equals zero in that case, mm-hmm. even though maybe it was some bracket of your H with your density, UV density may not be zero.
Yeah. It's a completely quantum term. It will vanish if everything commutes.
It's because of that formula that of the exponential, I guess.
No? Yes. So the classical corrections show up in the bearings, because now you have the bearings of this operator over here, which is why you get this additional term. But, yeah.
Hey, Harry, I'd like to understand something that also came up in Louise's talk. So you both say to build the best thermometer, you need a really big heat capacity, right? But when I talk to all my experimentalist friends, they say, no, you want to do the opposite. You want a very, very small heat capacity thing. Because when you start measuring that's going to alter the temperature of the thing you're measuring, right? So you can imagine if your system is really much bigger than your bath, and you have a huge heat capacity, you simply suck all the heat out of the bath and you change the temperature. So is there any way to kind of account for that kind of physical back action in this problem?
So you want both things, no? Like if you have a finite dimensional system, the heat capacity is limited. So you cannot have more than some amount of heat capacity. And you would say you have finite dimension in your thermometer, so you want to build it in